Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Caught Red podcast. As always, we are your hosts. I'm Megan Light.
And I'm Jesse Light.
We are just two dog lovers here to talk some true crime, horror movies, and of course, our doggos, too. And occasionally, the cats. If we brought Breeze in here, you would hear him.
He wanted to be in here. You're like, meow, meow,
meow, meow. Let's see. Falco got his teethuses done.
Poor guy.
He was a hot, hot, hot mess in the car going to my parents last night. They live like 15 minutes from our vet, which is way better than waking up at like 6 or 6:30 in the morning for us to drive. To make it there by like 7:30.
How much hair is in the car from him freaking out?
Well, I took all four in the car at different points today. So there's not really a car anymore. It's just fluff everywhere.
You need the shaggin' wagon on Dumb and Dumber.
It is now the shaggin' wagon of the lights. Yes. He did good. He had two pockets behind two teeth on the right side that thankfully were not abscesses, but she did some sort of like tooth filler injection thing, and it's supposed to help, but eventually he might have to have them pulled.
What was the bill on that?
It's fine, love.
Did they do that stuff without telling us and then just put it on the bill? Surprise!
Yeah. Hi! Well, I mean, if they had to take the teeth, they would have called first.
Would they have? You sure about that?
Yes. Then Ripley got groomed and she's a pretty girl. Her tail is so floofy.
And her fingers are showing.
Her fingers are terrifying. And she didn't eat the groomer. And it's now a joke up there when Ripley goes that, like, I picked her up today and her girl was like, she didn't eat me. I'm here. I was like, oh, I'm glad. But while they were both out of the house, I took the OGs, Derby and Mowgli, to the dog park for a little bit because I didn't want to just like take Mowgli somewhere and then leave Derby because, you know, that's like,
oh, she would have been pissed.
Can't do that. And then I didn't want to take her anywhere and just leave him because he never gets to go because he's so big. But he does really good with me. I don't know about with you, but he walks really well with me. He yelled at that strange man like, don't talk to my mom. And
that new harness does a lot.
Yeah, it's a good one. But they were good. They were all good today. I watched episodes 2, 3, and 4 of the new True Detective. I don't know how.
I was tapping my shit out the whole time.
I don't know. I was about to say, you were there physically, but you're there physically for a lot of the things that I watched.
Well, I would look up whenever all the crazy stuff was going on. Mm-hmm. Like whenever Jodie Foster had sex, I was like, what the hell?
What are watching porn over here? I liked it. It's getting really good. I'm intrigued. I don't know what it's going to be. It's more than just
some supernatural crime. Stuff. Yeah. Huh?
Yes, please. All the way. Then we had The Beekeeper.
The Beekeeper.
I watched the gynecologist. Jesse finished it. Mom and Dad watched it. They liked it a lot.
Don't mess with the chef.
Hey, you could do that voice more often. That was pretty good.
That one sounded like him?
Yeah.
The Beekeeper.
Yeah, that does sound a lot like him. It's like your typical Jason Statham movie.
Action movie. He's always playing this random role. It's like a mechanic or something, but he's a badass somehow. Right.
He kills a bunch of people. Ex-military.
Don't want to fuck with him or anybody that he's close to. Otherwise, he's going to come after you. With a spork.
Or something. I said that I was going to mention a couple books to a few people. So I'm just going to name a couple. Not like all 13 that I read last month. Just a few of the ones I really liked. Starting with Don't Look for Me by Wendy Walker. Which I have another one of hers downstairs. Our homegirl Christy's got a couple other ones, and I'm waiting to hear back about those, but I know they're going to be great also. But this was a very interesting one. It has to do with the mom that they think just walked away from her life, but she did not. Then I'm going to go ahead and talk about If I Go Missing by Leslie Wolf. She is a teacher, and she is adamant after a missing girl from her childhood, they finally find evidence and find her body, that she wants all the kids in her class and all these other children and parents to start making If I Go Missing binders. So it has like all your information, all your passwords, DNA, it's got a hair sample, it's got all kinds of stuff. So if you were, heaven forbid, to go missing, they could try to find you. And it's got a bunch of twists and turns. I liked it a lot. I've been on a Minka Kent, M-I-N-K-A, Kent binge, because so many of her books are on Kindle Unlimited. So I've just been running through all those. And I did want to mention one in particular called When I Was You. It's a great one. It's, you think it has to do with this woman stealing this other woman's identity and living her life as her, but it's not really what you think. And so I would highly recommend that one. But all of her books I've read on Kindle have been top notch. That's why I've been just flying through them all. I'm like, oh, that one's available. Let me click on that and read it. And then I would, that's probably why I read so many, because I'll find the one author that I really like and then I'll just read everything available by then. And then I'm like, all right, moving on.
Just binge straight through them.
Yeah. Like Freida McFadden. She's what they call popcorn thriller.
Her name's Freedom.
Freida.
Freida. Oh, Freida.
Freida.
Freida. Freida. Yeah.
McFadden. And she writes just really quick thriller books that you can just speed through. Like I read through all of hers on my Kindle, and she just released a new one yesterday, and I started it last night at Mom and Dad's. So I'm sure I'll finish it tonight. Not bragging. But also bragging. Jesse has today's episode. Are you ready to teach us a few things?
Yeah, there's like 10 names I had to learn to pronunciate on here. But yeah, I'm ready.
Well, get it, love.
All right. My sources are an article written by C.S. Murphy in the Arkansas Democratic Gazette. Got an A Magazine article called Murder Mystery by Janie Jones. Then you got one, you'll like the name of this one, Murder on the Menu by Graham Cates.
I like it.
And then another article called Five Things to Know About the VDOC Society by Sarah Callums. Last but not least, Lunch and a Murder by Dan Lewis. So it just reminds me of the movie The Menu for some reason, but
that was good. That was such a good one.
It was weird, but it was good. Oh, TV shows, especially the ones that Megan loves, like Bones and Rizzoli and Isles and Law and Order SVU.
The Closer.
That was next on the list.
Yeah.
Criminal Minds, X-Files, Castle have trained us to believe that murder cases are investigated by multiple highly experienced homicide detectives who have access to unlimited resources. Everything is at their disposal, from high-level scientific testing labs that can extract fingerprints and DNA from absolutely nothing.
Go CSI all the way.
They've got machines that can take the worst quality camera image and just turn it into the clearest image possible to identify the suspect. Like, come on. That's not always the case in real life. The reality is that, and especially in these small towns where their budget is next to nothing, that solving cases is much harder than it looks. They don't have Detective Rizzoli to team up with. But what these small town investigators can do is call the VDOC Society. The VDOC Society was formed in 1990 by a group of friends. You got William Fleischer.
Are these the names that you had to look up?
Not all of them, but that was one. Richard Walter and Frank Bender. And they were just eating lunch one day at a restaurant in Philadelphia. It was actually this French Renaissance-style brick mansion that houses the Union League, one of Philadelphia's oldest and most elite social clubs. And they would just get together there and talk about unsolved crimes that really piqued their interest. And they took it upon themselves to re-examine some of these cold cases. Fleischer was a polygraph and interrogation expert. Walter was a forensic psychologist and a criminal profiler.
Very cool.
And Bender was a facial reconstructionist and sketch artist who specialized in age progression. So how cool would that be just to sit down with all three of those guys? The three of them actually had helped each other out over the phone for years, but the first time they met face-to-face was in May of 1989. Walter and Bender had actually teamed up in 1989 to help capture John List.
That's why you were asking about him.
If you'd ever heard of him?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he was an accountant from Westfield, New Jersey, who disappeared in 1971 after murdering his mother, his wife, and his three children. Walter came up with the psychological profile of List, and Bender created an age progression photo of List. It had been 18 years since the murders and List being on the run, and it only took 11 days after the photos and profile were shown on America's Most Wanted.
Dude.
List was arrested in Virginia, where he had remarried and was living this quiet life under a different name.
That's wild.
But he never would have been found if it wasn't for those two guys. No way. After 18 years like that, that's crazy.
And his new wife has no idea what his old wife went through.
No kidding.
Like,
wonder what made him just snap and
I don't know.
Do what he did. They knew that if they put all their skills together, though, the chances of solving these cold cases would increase. And one of the three suggested that they make it a regular event to meet up at the restaurant. And then another one of them suggested that they invite others from the law enforcement world. So they sent out 28 invitations, not expecting like too many replies back, really. But in fact, they received 26 acceptances.
Wow.
So it was like on the third Thursday of every month, these guys, along with other top detectives and investigators, would gather for lunch at this restaurant. And the VDOC Society had grown to include coroners, judges, lawyers, and criminologists, as well as profilers, forensic scientists, medical examiners, and polygraph examiners. The number of official members was always limited to 82. And I'll explain that.
I was going to say, that's kind of a random number. Yeah.
It was actually how old the person was that died that it's named after.
Okay.
So it's also a nonprofit organization. Police departments can request assistance from the society free of charge. And the society is funded by a combination of donations and dues. Just $100 per year for each member, so that's really not that bad at all.
Mm-mm.
Cops and law enforcement types from all over the country will make the journey to Philadelphia for a chance to just trade notes and theories with the VDOC Society. Oftentimes, the society will cover the airfare and hotel expenses, too, for those investigators. But the society will only consider cases that meet the following criteria. So they're just not going after every single cold case. They've got...
Yeah, they'd be broke.
Yeah, true. So the cold case must be more than 2 years old. Victims cannot be involved in any criminal activity. And then the case must be presented formally by a law enforcement agency. So they don't work directly with family members or friends of the victims.
Keep in an official capacity.
Right. So if you haven't figured it out already, this case is about the VDOC Society. And it was named after Eugene Francois VDOC.
Eugene, this is probably the only good and smart Eugene.
I don't know.
That we're going to talk about.
I don't know. Hold your horses.
Nay.
Well, this guy had a heck of a story. They always say if you want to catch a thief, you got to send a thief, because no one understands a criminal like a criminal would, you know? Eugene Vidocq, growing up, was the definition of a criminal.
Oh, well.
Yeah, I said, hold your horses. Most of what I read about his early days actually came from him, because he wrote an autobiography called Memoirs of Vidocq.
Oh, very cool.
Very cool. Eugene Francois Vidocq was born in the city of Ahas in northern France on July 23rd, 1775. So, yeah, way back in the day. He was the third of seven children of Nicholas Francois Vidocq and his wife Henriette. It was a rough area of Ahas, so Eugene got into fights at a very young age. But he was a pretty tough kid. He could hold his own. He actually got into fencing when he was 13 years old and was like this child prodigy at it. But he was a troublemaker. So he worked for his father's bakery by making deliveries around town, but he would steal money from his father to go drink at the pub.
Oh my gosh.
He was making friends with the wrong crowd. And his father found out he was stealing and began locking the cash box, but Eugene just forged the key with the help of a blacksmith's son.
I mean, okay. Do what you gotta do. Get them dollars.
Yeah, but his father put a stop to that. But then Vidocq just began stealing from other people instead. At least he wasn't stealing from his father anymore. This led to his first arrest. Instead of learning his lesson, he figured that he would go for one big score and then just skip town. So he broke into his father's bakery and stole 2,000 francs and was out of there. I also read in another article that he had accidentally killed his... Are you looking up how much 2,000 francs is? I didn't do that. Go ahead. But yeah, I also read that he accidentally killed his fencing instructor, and instead of facing the consequences, he fled town. So that might have been the reason he left. I'm not 100% certain there. It was a long time ago. While on the streets, Vidocq was forced to take employment with a group of performers. They treated him like shit, and he was beaten on the regular and fed scraps. And he was so run down, he pretty much looked like a POW. He was forced to leave, and then he joined a group of puppeteers. But this didn't last, because he had the hots for this boss's wife. So he got kicked out of that. And then he eventually made his way back home, where his father forgave him for stealing from his bakery. And he enlisted in the army and joined the Bourbon regime. After a short period, he earned the nickname Reckless because of all the fights he got into. He dueled 15 times and killed two men. So, yes, this was back when duels were still a thing. In 1792, you want to bring him back? We can just bring him back. It's fine.
Yeah, I'm down.
Did you find how much a franc was?
Well, it kept popping up as a Swiss franc.
Oh, I don't know.
And then I looked at French francs, and it was like some dollar weird thing. I didn't want to figure it out. So
math.
I don't like math.
In 1792, France went to war with Austria in the War of the First Coalition, and Vidocq was promoted to the grenadier, but received a court-martial for hitting an officer, so he left. He joined the 11th Chasseurs, under a different name. He ended up getting shot in the leg and returned to Ahas when he was 18 years old. So he's had...
That he's just now 18.
Yeah, he's lived a long life, hadn't he? And he was in and out of prison most of the time, but he was an escape artist. So he'd get in, he's like, no big deal, I'm out of here. Well, yeah, he was...
Everything else that he's done up to the age of 18, I would expect him to be an escape artist.
Yeah, no surprise. He probably learned it from his performers and the puppeteers. Who knows? He went to Brussels at one point under a different name, Monsieur Rousseau. He joined the army and became a hussar captain. He hooked up with an elderly widowed baroness who gave him a large amount of money, and he pretty much lived the high life in Paris for a very short time with all that money until it was gone. Then he went back to prison again. So you're probably wondering, like, why the heck did those three guys name their society after this guy?
I know, and I take back my Eugene comment because obviously he's not a good and smart one.
Well, he ended up turning his life around, though, okay? So he's got a lot of life to live still. This was only, like, when he was 18, so after multiple prison escapes, he felt like enough was enough. His father had passed away, and his mother was on her own, so he finally decided to do some good, and he became a prison informant. A police chief named Jean Henry accepted the deal and relocated Vidocq to La Force prison in Paris. In exchange for his work as a prison informant, he would receive amnesty and the security of a steady income. And he was a very successful spy for the police and played a big role in the arrest of some of his former buddies. But the criminal world eventually caught on to his act, but he found a way around it by wearing disguises. And he was already a pro at his aliases, you know, he's coming up with different names to use. He was so convincing one time that someone actually hired him to kill himself.
What?
Like, someone hired him to kill
Eugene.
Eugene Vidocq, yeah, but he's Eugene Vidocq, but nobody knows that that's who he is. Ain't that crazy?
I guess they don't have great optometrists back then either, so if somebody was like, you don't look like him, I don't think. Well,
if you had bad eyesight, you're just shit out of luck back then?
Yeah. They couldn't tell him apart with the disguise on. I just figured their eyesight's bad.
I guess. Well, to improve the efficiency of the Paris police force, Vidocq actually suggested the formation of a small group of men who could facilitate cooperation between the city's police precincts. And he chose men like himself, who were former criminals, because, like I said before, who better to catch a crook than another crook?
Mm-hmm.
His undercover unit was called the Brigade Sûreté, or Security of Brigade.
It's your turn.
I'm telling
to
you.
To have all these I'm words and names. You. I'm so proud of you.
They were the forerunner of today's French National Police Force. So the Sûreté became a unit of plainclothes detectives under the watchful eye of Paris police. And Vidocq trained all of his agents personally. Even when he had a few dozen men working under him, he still liked to dress up as a beggar and work undercover on the streets. His unit was responsible for hundreds of arrests and reportedly decreased the crime rate in Paris by up to 40%.
That's great.
And then in 1817 alone, they made 811 arrests, including 341 thieves, 46 forgers, 14 escaped prisoners, and 15 assassins. Just criminals catching criminals. It was pretty amazing.
Makes me think of Blackbird or kind of like White Collar, too. Do you ever watch that?
No, but Blackbird, for sure, when they sent him in to figure out where he buried all those kids.
And there's another show, I can't think of it, but I can kind of see it, that they used somebody that was in prison or on the other side of it, and he helps the police. But it's going to bug me, and I'm going to think about it. And when I randomly think of it...
You're going to wake up in the middle of the night and scream the name out?
Yeah, probably.
In the early 1830s, Vidocq resigned from the police force after he was accused of staging a crime for the purpose of solving it. But investigative work was just in his blood, so he wasn't going to let this deter him. He founded the first private detective agency.
No shit.
He was still hiring ex-convicts, many former agents of the Sûreté. He is credited with introducing the science of ballistics to police force, as well as the use of plaster cast to preserve footprints. He held patents on indelible ink and unalterable bond paper. He was also known to have introduced record keeping and criminalistics. He was a philanthropist, helping the poor and downtrodden, especially the wrongfully accused. So that is why they pretty much named the society after him.
Okay.
He laid the groundwork for what a detective should be. He wasn't a Sherlock Holmes, really, you know. He was more of a successful psychologist, really, than a detective, because he knew how to use his appearance and reputation and attitude to get other criminals to trust him. He was known to have a great memory and kept an accurate and detailed record of all the criminals he came across, too. So he was just great at record keeping. And all that's just pretty impressive for someone in the 1800s. I just thought that was truly ahead of its time, really. His legacy and tradition of crime solving was carried on by the VDOC Society members. Oftentimes, detectives are stuck for years looking for that one clue that could break the case. We've had a few of those.
Mm-hmm.
The Melissa Witt one.
J.C. Ryder.
Old J.C. Ryder. The members of the VDOC Society are always there to lend a helping hand. It's just not too many people know about them, really. And it's not like they're out there trying to brag about or, you know, boast, mm-hmm. show off or anything.
That's not their purpose.
Yeah, they kind of just keep to themselves.
When you were talking about this the other day, the name VDOC sounded really familiar, but I knew nothing about it.
I'd never heard of it.
I think I'd read it like in a book or something, like glazed over it, but didn't ever like, oh, what's that? I just thought it was like something made up for that book.
Yeah. Well, they're not looking for the fame and fortune. They're just trying to solve cases that hadn't been solved yet. And that's just what they did for a family from Little Rock, Arkansas in 1991, which was their first ever case as the VDOC Society. So that's how cool. Crazy is that?
I love
that
it.
Arkansas was the first
the
case.
Number one.
The family of a murder victim named Huey Cox from Little Rock, Arkansas, believed that the man charged with the crime was innocent, and the members of the VDOC agreed. Two of them even provided expert testimony at the trial, and the case ended up being dismissed. Huey Cox was one of six children in a close family. He graduated from Catholic high school.
Ah.
And was diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease, which required several surgeries and chemotherapy and radiation treatments. To offset side effects of those treatments, Cox would smoke marijuana. After remission, he continued to smoke, but he would drink pretty heavily as well. His motto was basically YOLO. He became this argumentative, stubborn, and sometimes malicious and vengeful person when he disagreed with people. His life revolved around his work. He was a co-manager at J.R. Ribs Restaurant, which was within walking distance of his apartment on Old Forge Road. And people that knew him characterized him as an offensive and belligerent individual who had problems dealing with people. And this made his co-workers not want to work with him. And they were pretty much just ready to quit if he stayed at the job with them. So, I mean, it was probably due to his Hodgkin's disease, I guess, just having to deal with that. Cox would end up getting fired, and after he was fired, he threatened his co-workers that he would expose their drug use and extramarital affairs. And within 2 days of the last time he left the restaurant, Huey Cox was murdered. His roommate discovered his body on the floor of their living room at 4:35 p.m., March 6, 1991. Several friends, co-workers, and family members had went into the apartment before police arrived to the scene.
Oh, no.
Obviously, the crime scene had been contaminated. Some even admitted to altering the crime scene and removing a marijuana bong. At first, police believed that Cox had killed himself with a handgun, but the state medical examiner determined that Cox died of blunt force trauma with 8 to 10 wounds to his head.
Dang.
And, yeah. Brutal. No other wounds were found on his body, and there was no indication that he fought his attacker either. It definitely looked like there was anger on the part of the offender. It was 8 to 10 hits with a golf club. A 7-iron, to be exact. Of course, Megan, they're all putters to her.
They're all putters.
But that's definitely excessive. Then the lack of defensive injuries suggested that it was a surprise attack on an unsuspecting or incapacitated victim. Whoever killed Cox had an intense personal anger against him. Like I said, the evidence found in the apartment was the 7-iron golf club, and then there was a cloth towel and a steel wood pad that may have been used to clean off the murder weapon. And then Huey's wallet was found in a trash bin close by his apartment. It wasn't believed that the killer was motivated by robbery. They think it could have just been an effort to disguise or stage the crime to appear as robbery motivated, because there was no signs of forced entry and the apartment didn't appear to be disturbed. Little Rock police arrested a man named Derek Carlock and charged him with Cox's murder. At the time of his arrest, Carlock and another man were in jail on capital murder charges involving the robbery and shooting death of an elderly man. Now, Huey's family, especially his sister, Teresa Bowles, strongly believed that Carlock was innocent of Huey's death. In fact, they were dead set that the murderer was actually someone else that they had their eyes on. None of the articles, though, that I ever read ever mentioned this other suspect by name, but it was someone that Huey knew personally. And they just couldn't believe that the police charged Carlock, who they reportedly said bragged in a Lee County jail that he had killed a Little Rock man.
Well, that could have been anybody.
Yeah, I mean, inmates do that sometimes, too. They like to brag about stuff that they didn't do.
Sound bigger and better and tougher and scarier.
Yeah, trying to earn a big reputation or something, you know. Before Carlock's trial, Teresa Bowles reached out to the VDOC Society to look at the case and help the family prove Carlock's innocence. Now, remember I said that
the family couldn't ask.
Yeah, that was one of the requirements. And it made me think, like, was that a requirement they made after this? Or were they just a little lenient?
They got involved and were stepping on the Little Rock PD's toes or something, and they were like, oh, well, I know y'all didn't ask us, but...
Yeah, it was their first case, so they probably learned from it and was like, okay, we got to do this a little different in the future. That's what I think anyways. The family knew that if Carlock was convicted, the real killer would get away with it and be roaming the streets a free man. Bowles said she probably talked to Fleischer every week for almost 2 years. And remember, Fleischer was one of the original three and was a former Philadelphia police officer and FBI special agent. Walter, the forensic psychologist and criminal profiler, and then they had FBI special agent Greg McCrary, who assisted with the case as well. They all ultimately agreed with the Cox's family that Carlock was innocent of this crime. Fleischer felt like the police just found a convenient suspect and overlooked the real suspect.
Well, Old Forge, it's not really the best area nowadays. I don't know about in the 90s, but it connects to Reservoir.
Oh, okay.
It goes from Rodney Parham, and then it's a little two-way side street, and then it can end up on Reservoir.
I drive that once a week.
So, yeah, it's over there by that Shell gas station.
I thought it sounded familiar. I just couldn't think of where it was.
For those not in our area, Reservoir Drive has a couple of nice houses and like one decent neighborhood, but then there's a lot of lower income apartments.
Well, that's where the tornado hit pretty hard too.
It was in the, what is that bowling alley called?
Professional or Professor?
Professor Bowl.
Yeah.
And then across the street from that is TJ Maxx.
Yes. I drove by there today. They got a barber college over there.
They do. Dollar Tree, I think.
Yeah.
Drug Emporium. Which is just a grocery store for weird stuff.
There used to be a Doubleby's over there. They sold it. But yeah, Fleischer felt like for sure the crime was a retaliatory rage kind of thing, and it wasn't a robbery. After a 3-day capital murder trial, the jury deliberated less than an hour before acquitting Carlock. But the Little Rock police believed, even after the trial was over, that they had arrested the right suspect. The VDOC Society and Teresa Bowles proved otherwise, obviously. Teresa Bowles led the way in keeping her brother's case from being swept under the rug in the years to follow. She said she knew who killed her brother. There was no doubt in her mind. They just had to be patient.
The roommate?
No, they never found out who killed him. Well, they never proved who killed him.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I don't know if it was a roommate. Like I said, they never said a name. Fleischer called Bowles an American hero. He said, that's how justice is supposed to work. To me, she epitomized everything I like about humankind. In the times we live in and the work I'm in, it's nice to meet people like her. The Cox family and members of the VDOC Society weren't the only ones who questioned whether police and prosecutors had taken the wrong path in the Cox investigation. Circuit Judge Marion Humphrey, who heard the Carlock case, wrote a letter to Governor Jim Guy Tucker shortly after the trial in 1993. He urged him to ask the prosecuting attorney to step aside and appoint a special prosecutor and grand jury to investigate the case. He said that Mr. Carlock's defense in the Cox case mirrored the contentions of Mr. Cox's family and suggested that another person murdered Mr. Cox. He said that person was actually a witness for the protection. Humphrey also said that a juror told him after the trial that the sentiment of the jury during its deliberations was that the wrong man had been prosecuted. And then a court bailiff reported that he overheard the wife of the man who the Cox family believed was the killer talking on the phone and saying that she believed that her husband killed Mr. Cox.
Dang.
Isn't that crazy? But even after hearing what Judge Humphrey had to say, Governor Tucker took no action.
He has better things to do, my guy.
His hands were tied or something. I don't know. And then you got a FBI profiler named Stephen Mardigian, who also took interest in this case, and he felt like Cox was a victim of violence stemming from his lifestyle, personality, and behavior. He believed this was not a stranger-related crime, but rather a homicide motivated by personal cause resulting from an interpersonal relationship. The last information I found on this case was back in 2011. A close friend of Cox came forward with information about a conversation that he had with Cox shortly before he died. The family believed that the information would help in the investigation. Bowles said the friend told them some things that they didn't know that had to do with Huey's murder. Bowles and the friend met with the leaders of the Little Rock PD cold case unit. Bowles said that they were fantastic and very professional and helpful. She gave the detectives copies of documents that weren't in the original case file, including an FBI profile completed in 1996. although they never arrested or convicted the real killer, they were able to avoid wrongfully convicting this Derek Carlock guy. Unfortunately, he was a piece of shit human anyways.
Yeah, I looked him up after the fact. He's not yeah, good. He's
no good.
He's in prison right now, I believe.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he won't be eligible for parole until 2043. He would end up being convicted of the first-degree murder of that elderly man that he was originally in jail for awaiting the trial. And then he was paroled in 1999, only to return to prison the following year on rape and weapon charges. So, yeah.
Just keep him. We don't need him.
Teresa and the family stayed pretty positive about the whole situation. It's never too late to go back and do something right. It's never a sin to admit you're wrong. They can still solve this thing. There's still a chance in the future that they can put it to bed and give some peace of mind to the family. I mean, we've seen cases solved after being cold for like 30 years. Mm-hmm. It's not out of the realm of possibilities.
And technically, this one was just about solved. They just didn't, I guess, have the nail in the coffin to get the guy that they all suspected anyways.
You just think with all the advancements of DNA technology, too, you just never know. They might have something on this guy, or heck, he could be in prison for something else now. Who knows?
Very true.
Or it could just take somebody to come forward with some information like that friend did and somebody actually do something about it.
Or talk the wife into finally talking about the conversation the bailiff apparently heard.
Yeah, that's crazy. The VDOC Society doesn't keep official statistics for the success rate of the organization, but there was an article in 2012 where Fleischer estimated that the club had a direct contribution in over 40 homicide investigations. And I'm sure there's a ton more after that. As of 2021, Fleischer served as commissioner of the society. Walter left the society in 2016, and Bender died in 2011. Over 30 years have passed since the Cox case. The VDOC Society has helped solve cases like the Arizona Canal murders, and of course that John List family annihilator case. The group stresses that it doesn't want fame or glory because often there is none. But the society does wish that more investigators were aware of their services. They can only hope that they can have the opportunity to work more cases and continue the detective legacy of Eugene VDOC. And that is the story of the VDOC Society.
That's real cool.
A little different.
I like it.
Thought I'd switch things up a bit.
I like your style. How lucky for us to be the first go-around for them.
Well, I was going to do another Cox case, but I saw this Cox case, and I was like, huh, let's do this Cox case instead.
Too many Coxes out there to choose from.
Well, then they started showing Dewey Cox, the movie. Uh-huh. I was like, no, that's the wrong Cox.
That's got to be frustrating for the Cox family, because they obviously know who it was.
Yeah, just imagine if you see him in the grocery store or something.
I was going to say, yeah, or like the sister is just parked outside the house staring at him.
Following him, waiting until he does something else.
Mm-hmm. That's probably why they go through law enforcement now, since family members aren't really, you know, trained and...
She's liable to do something stupid, yeah.
Good job, love.
Thank you.
That is going to wrap up today's episode, everybody. If you like us, follow us. We're on Instagram. We've got a Facebook page. You can look us up by doing Caught Red Podcast, and the pod is PAWD, just like all of our critters have. We love recommendations. It doesn't even have to be local to us. If it's local to you and you are passionate about it or it's interesting, send it our way. We'll be back next week with some more true crime. But until then, stay local, shop local,
and murder local.